The headlines: Iran and China sign a comprehensive partnership pact during the Chinese top diplomat's visit to Tehran. China announces sanctions on individuals and entities in the U.S. and Canada in response to sanctions imposed on Chinese citizens. And Lebanon's largest Christian bloc warns Prime Minister-designate Hariri against sidelining President Aoun and other parliamentary blocs in talks over cabinet formation. Hello and welcome from our headquarters in Tehran. Thank you for joining us. My name is Gisum Shahmadi, and these are our top stories this hour. Iran and China have signed a cooperation pact dubbed the Sino-Iranian Comprehensive Strategic Partnership. The deal was signed by foreign ministers of the two countries in Tehran. It includes cooperation in political, strategic, and economic fields. The terms of the pact were finalized during a meeting with the Chinese Foreign Minister Wang Yi and Ali Larijani, who is Iran's representative for pursuing the agreement. The Chinese official also met with President Hassan Rouhani during his visit. Political commentator James O'Neill says besides the importance of the Sino-Iranian cooperation agreement, the pact sends a message that Iran is a vital part of the world's economy and should not be treated unjustly.
Well, this is an incredibly important agreement that is being reached. It was initiated by the Chinese President Xi Jinping when he visited Tehran a couple of years ago. But primarily, it is a way of saying to the Americans that regardless of your illegal sanctions, the relationship between China and Iran is going to get stronger. And that's what's significant about this project. I think that it's a way of China telling the world that Iran is being treated unjustly. They do not accept its isolation by the United States, which is illegal. And China's agreement with Iran, which is going to cover the next 25 years, don't forget that's a very significant period in terms of world history. China is saying that Iran should not be isolated, that if you want to be part of the world economy, then Iran is a vital part of that and should be taken proper notice of. So I think other countries will follow China's example, particularly its near neighbour like Turkey, other countries in the Middle East and Russia have also signaled they're not going to participate in this American farce any longer of isolating Iran.
China has announced tit-for-tat sanctions on the U.S. and Canadian individuals and entities, the latest in the row over the alleged abuse of the country's Uyghur Muslim minority. The Chinese Foreign Ministry said the country would impose on three individuals and one entity from Canada and the United States. The ministry says this is in response to sanctions imposed on Chinese citizens and groups earlier this week by the two countries. Western governments have accused China of violating rights of Uyghurs in camps in Xinjiang region, saying that they are subject to forced labor. China has accused them of spreading lies and disinformation. Beijing says its camps in the region offer vocational training. Recently, China also imposed retaliatory sanctions on more than a dozen European and British entities and individuals. In this edition of the News Review, in Lebanon, the largest Christian bloc has warned Prime Minister-designate Saad Hariri against sidelining President Michel Aoun and other parliamentary blocs in cabinet negotiations. In a statement, the Free Patriotic Movement warned about the dangers of sidelining methods that Hariri is using when dealing with the president and concerned parliamentary blocs. The party also accused Hariri of trying to orchestrate a majority for his own supporters. Now, this days after the 18th meeting between Aoun and Hariri failed to reach an agreement over the formation of a cabinet. The Arab country has been struggling with a political crisis since August 10, when the government of then Prime Minister Hassan Diab resigned amid mounting public anger and protests over a deadly blast in Beirut. To discuss that further, we're joined by our correspondent Mariam Saleh, who is joining us live from Beirut, and also Jamal Wakim, author and a professor of the Lebanese University, also live from Beirut. Thanks to both of you for joining us. Now, let's begin with our correspondent Mariam. If you could please give us an update on how these negotiations are coming along.
Well, as you know, just recently, Prime Minister designate Saad Hariri and the president on how they will form the government. So basically what they are doing is the method of the formation. We had, of course, assistance from on the part of the Prime Minister designate that he wants an 18-minister cabinet. That is something the president has so far. He has accepted, but on certain terms. Those are terms that the Prime Minister designate has not accepted. But what is new here is that we have Prime Minister designate Saad Hariri going for talks on the sidelines with other groups, namely the Maronite Patriarch. And that was something that seemed to grab the attention of the Free Patriotic Movement, who considered that that was in some way or marginalizing President Michel Aoun, and that is they consider unacceptable. Now, as you know, based on the Constitution, the Prime Minister designate has to form the cabinet in coordination with the president, and the president, of course, has insisted that there are certain, if we may say, conditions that are related to how the government or how the country is now being governed on basically the fact that most of the parliament or the parliamentary blocs are still part of the political factions that are now in power. In order for a cabinet to be able to work successfully, it needs the trust, the confidence of that parliament. It needs to gather the support from the lawmakers. So basically, this is what they're trying to tell Saad Hariri. You cannot form a non-political government at this point in time until we have new parliamentary elections and the entire parliament changes.
Thank you very much. Now, to Jamal Wakim, do you believe that Saad Hariri will be able to form a government?
Well, I believe that Saad Hariri is entangled in in a very complicated situation. First, in the Lebanese political context, we know very well that it consists of a confederate of confessions, and the president of republic, prime minister, and speaker of parliament, they represent his own confession within the confessional system. And each confession has its alliances, regional and international alliances. Saad Hariri, he is supposedly backed by Saudi Arabia, or should win the favor of Saudi Arabia. The problem is that Saudi Arabia and the United States are pressuring Lebanon in order to form a government that does not include Hezbollah as part of the government. And as they couldn't pressure Hezbollah directly, they are exerting pressure on Hezbollah ally, who is the president of the republic, by trying to marginalize him through the demands and requests of Saad Hariri. And I believe that the other faction is waiting for talks on the regional and international levels in order to reach a deal in Lebanon. So the solution of the crisis in Lebanon would be part of a wider, let's say, regional deal between the United States, Saudi Arabia, and their allies on one hand, and on the other hand, Iran, Syria, and Russia, to a lesser extent. So this is from the point of view of local, let's say, powers. I believe that we have reached a stalemate, a deadlock actually, and there would not be a deal before, I believe, talk between the United States on one hand and Iran on the other hand.
Thank you very much. Now, back to our correspondent, Mariam Saleh. Mariam, some, if not all, of the economic issues that the Lebanese people are facing right now date back to the time when Saad Hariri himself was in office. Is he considered by the public part of the problem himself? And eventually, do you think that he will be able to continue governing Lebanon?
Well, he is definitely considered part of the problem, and he is also put in part with a group of elite, which is the political elite that has been governing Lebanon for quite a long time. And what we're hearing right now is part of that continuous reciprocal accusations that you hear from the political factions, whether it is the Free Patriotic Movement against the Future Movement led by Saad Hariri or Saad Hariri's group against other groups, whether Christian or Muslims and so on and so forth, all the groups blaming each other. But the fact that we have a political figure who is coming, and he, one of his, let's say, initiatives or his endeavors is trying to form a non-political cabinet. This is unheard of. This is unprecedented here in Lebanon, and it seems almost impossible. Now, of course, you have factions like Hezbollah who have said that we need to go to the judicial system, but a lot of people don't have trust in the judicial system. But when you talk about the popular, spirit or morale, it's really down to the ground right now with everything that's happening with this economic, socio-economic, financial, monetary, multifaceted crisis that we're facing right now. People have absolutely no trust in most of the politicians, or maybe all the politicians. So what we're trying to see is something that is almost impossible to do, especially in light of the current context that we have. But in one, I think, key term here is the auditing that we have that we need to do in order to make reforms. And that is something that Saad Hariri does not want, while the president does. And many of them are accusing Saad Hariri of the fact that he wants to be in control of the cabinet without anyone actually holding him accountable, or just being not, you know, he's always standing in the way of reforms. This is what the Free Patriotic Movement are saying. The Free Patriotic Movement, it was what the group founded by President Michel Aoun and is now, of course, headed by his son-in-law, Gibran Bessie. And despite the fact that there are some accusations against them as well, however, they are calling for a clear investigation, whether it is in the issues related to corruption, and that everyone should be held accountable. And they're saying if Saad Hariri is going to be in power, that won't be very possible in the near future.
Thank you very much. Mr. Jamal Wakim, we're running out of time. You lined up a number of countries that are trying to influence the situation in Lebanon. Which country do you believe benefits most from instability in Lebanon? We have less than a minute.
Well, I believe it's the United States of America. Because on the geopolitical level, after having lost much of ground in Syria, they want to, make up for this loss in Iraq and in Lebanon by making a political reshuffle to their favor, either put both countries under their full political hegemony or transform these countries as a bleeding side for Syria and for Iran, to exhaust both Syria and Iran. Especially in the case of Lebanon, we know very well the complex relationship between the economic elites in Lebanon and in Syria, and Lebanon has always been a gateway of foreign capital towards Syria. So in causing a crisis in Lebanon, this window, this economic window and financial window for the Syrian capitalists would be blocked, and this hence reconstruction would be hindered in this period.
Thank you very much, Mr. Jamal Wakim, author and professor at the Lebanese University in Beirut, and also our correspondent, Mariam Saleh, both of them joining us live from the Lebanese capital. Thank you very much to both of you, and thanks to all of you for following this edition of the News Review. Moving on, Germany has registered over 20,000 new coronavirus infections as it struggles against the third wave of the pandemic. According to the Robert Koch Institute for Infectious Diseases, Germany also reported 157 COVID-19 fatalities over the past day. That takes its death toll closer to 76,000. The country has so far reported over 2.7 million cases. Health experts have warned that Germany could see 100,000 infections a day if the third wave of the coronavirus spreads unchecked. Germany's intensive care doctors have called for a two-week hard lockdown in order to avoid overwhelming the healthcare system. Chancellor Angela Merkel reversed plans for a strict lockdown over the Easter holidays a day after the measure was announced. France has accused Britain of blackmail over the coronavirus vaccine exports amid a growing row over the jab supply in Europe.
We cannot deal this way and play blackmail insofar as we wanted to vaccinate without stopping for the first dose, and now we find ourselves a bit handicapped for the second dose. Europe does not have to pay the cost of these policies.
French Foreign Minister Jean-Yves Le Drian called on the European Union to control exports of the AstraZeneca vaccine. He expressed hope that the EU and the UK can reach an agreement so that the British-Swedish AstraZeneca company can fulfill its vaccine deliveries. Vaccination programs have been sluggish across Europe. The EU blames pharmaceutical companies for inability to deliver the promised doses. The bloc has warned ban AstraZeneca vaccine exports to provide the EU with required doses. Meanwhile, Iran has reported over 8,000 new coronavirus cases and 85 more related deaths. According to the health ministry, 15 people have been hospitalized over the past day. This is while 1.6 million people have recovered from the disease. The number of new cases and deaths in Iran has sharply dropped since November, when the country imposed tough restrictions to curb the pandemic. However, officials have sounded the alarm over the complacency and laxity in following health protocols, as well as the spread of the more contagious and deadly variants of the virus. On Saturday, Tehran was designated as a high risk in terms of transmission. Travel to and from the capital has been banned. Iran has so far registered over 1.8 million infections and more than 62,000 deaths. Belarusian officials have warned people against public demonstrations threatening disobeyers with criminal prosecution. The warning came ahead of an expected new round of protests. Armored vehicles and police buses have moved into the center of the capital, Minsk, in preparation for potential demonstrations. Belarus has been the scene of protests since the presidential elections back in August 2019. The vote was won by longtime President Alexander Lukashenko. The opposition rejected the election results as rigged. The government has dismissed these allegations and has accused the West of stoking artificial tensions in Belarus. Opposition figures have recently called on their supporters to ramp up rallies after a two-month pause. And in Myanmar, more than 90 people have been reportedly killed during fresh clashes in one of the deadliest protests since last month's military coup. Some 30 people died in the country's second-largest city, Mandalay, and 24 in the commercial capital, Yangon. Myanmar has been in turmoil since the de facto leader, Aung San Suu Kyi, was dropped out in a coup on February the 1st. The military argued that the November election won by Suu Kyi's party was fraudulent. The Election Commission denies that. Security forces have used tear gas, rubber bullets, and live rounds against anti-coup protesters so far. More than 400 people have been killed in the unrest. With that, we come to the end of this edition of World News. Stay tuned.
If you're interested to know about history, culture, family, politics, religion, art, etc. You wouldn't want to miss the chance to tune into the IRIB English Radio. Please log on to our website, www.parstoday.com/en.
Just as spring revives and regenerates nature, Imam Mahdi, may God hasten his reappearance, breathes new spirit into the corpse of society and revives it. He revives the dead souls and ignorant humans with knowledge and awareness. When he reappears, the public culture advances in human society and corruption is uprooted. People will become very kind and sympathetic to one another. There won't be such phrases like, "That's your problem." Everyone will feel responsibility towards the problems of others. In short, everyone will consider another one's problem as his own problem. Almighty has created the world in a way that is dominated by human beings so that he can make the best use of it. The merciful God has put the spring beauties and bounties in the control of all, faithful and the faithless, pious and impious are all benefiting from these bounties. Spring is God's public spread. God says in verse 50 of Surah Rum in the Holy Quran, "So observe the effects of Allah's mercy, how he revives the earth after its death. Indeed, he has power over all things." Spring is the manifestation of God's all-encompassing mercy. Basically, taking pleasure is one of the features of human being. He or she takes pleasure in eating, drinking, talking with friends, and so on. Islam emphasizes that a believer should do his or her work with pleasure. Now spring has arrived with all of its beauties. It is we who should not pass by these beauties carelessly. We should rather ponder on them to be admonished. We must thank God for these bounties. According to religious teachings, being thankful of God will materialize by using his bounties in the correct way. Islam is not opposed to pleasure. It advises human beings to enjoy God's bounties in the best way possible and take pleasure with every bounty. But it prevents us from forbidden pleasures which are not real pleasures. Forbidden or illegitimate pleasures are the ones that harm either the individual or other individuals. They are harmful both in this world and in the hereafter. God says in verse 32 of Surah A'raf in the Holy Quran, addressing the Prophet, the Almighty says, "Say, who has forbidden the adornment of Allah, which He has brought forth for His servants, and the good things of provision? Say, these are for the faithful in the life of this world, and exclusively for them on the day of resurrection. Thus do we elaborate the signs for a people who have knowledge." In fact, the Holy Quran deplores trivial and transient pleasures and underlines permanent ones. In view of a faithful person, there is no pleasure superior to God's satisfaction. That's why he or she strives to attain God's satisfaction in every deed. The Almighty says in verse 17 of Surah Allah in the Holy Quran that the hereafter is better and more lasting. So there are two criteria for evaluation. One points to the quality and the other points to quantity. The faithful who contemplate on the divine bounties and believe in God's promise wait for the coming of the promised Saviour of mankind, Imam Mahdi, may God hasten his reappearance. The Almighty says in verse 96 of Surah A'raf in the Holy Quran, "If the people of the towns had been faithful and God-weary, we would have opened to them the blessings from the heavens and the earth." The day of Imam Mahdi's reappearance will mark the start of the Almighty's sending down special bounties and blessings. When he comes, the heavens will give their bounties more generously to human beings. Then human beings will enjoy these bounties in the way of worship and servitude of God. As we recite in the supplication, iftitah or opening supplication, in the nights of the blessed month of Ramadan, the rule of Imam Mahdi, may God hasten his reappearance, is the noble government, or Dawlat-e-Karimah. It is during that rule that mankind will enjoy the true meaning of dignity and humane values under the divine laws. We all pray to God to expedite the reappearance of the awaited Saviour of mankind, the last infallible successor of Prophet Muhammad, blessings of God upon him and his progeny, the Imam of the age, Imam Mahdi, may God hasten his reappearance. According to a narration, if the entire knowledge of mankind was 27 parts, only 2 parts will be known and discovered till the coming of Imam Mahdi. True knowledge and cognizance of God will materialize during his era.
From the heart of beautiful Iran. IRIB English Radio.
Africa Today. French President Emmanuel Macron says that he won't reduce the number of troops deployed in Africa's Sahel region, despite pressure from home and abroad to do so. Macron made the remarks after talks in February with leaders of the five Sahel countries.
Tighten our grip on the three borders, especially with the Chadian battalion. But starting from the coming days and weeks to lead concrete operations in this zone to regain control.
Hello, I'm Mubarak Kenya, and welcome to this week's edition of Africa Today, which is focusing on renewed efforts by France to tighten its grip on Africa's Sahel region. We are asking, is France in the Sahel to combat terrorism or to exploit the region's natural resources, especially uranium, which it desperately needs to produce electricity? In the second part of our program, we shall go deep into Africa's Great Rift Valley and see how Kenya has become Africa's number one geothermal energy producer and among the top 10 in the world.
Now we're in Olkaria, and this is where we have the geothermal power plants, the biggest plant in Africa.
So stay tuned as our experts give us an in-depth analysis, and don't forget to visit our social media pages and post your comments on today's program.
French troops and Sahel uranium. The Sahel is a vast African area with a population of almost 100 million people across five countries: Burkina Faso, Chad, Mali, Mauritania, and Niger, which form the G5 Sahel. Takfiri terrorism, trafficking of arms, drugs and people, and other transitional forms of organized crime are threatening security in this region. French President Emmanuel Macron has said he won't change the number of troops deployed in the region. Currently, France has deployed at least 5,100 troops in the Sahel region. Macron made the declaration after February talks with the leaders of the G5 Sahel grouping. He described any rushed exit as a mistake.
I think that rushing into a French pullout, at least a willingness to massively remove men, which is one of the options I looked at, would be a mistake. And that's the fruit of the discussions I've had with each leader.
On paper, the French military is currently in the Sahel to fight terrorism. But others say the real reason France continues to risk the lives of its troops in this region it once colonized is to protect French economic and geostrategic interests, especially exploitation of the gold and uranium mines.
Now, for more on this, we have contacted Daniel Lazar, a New York-based journalist and author. Thanks a lot for your time, Mr. Lazar. Now, what do you think is the source of the conflict in the Sahel, and how did we get this far?
The Sahel has always been an area of political turbulence and instability, at least going back to the 1960s. But certainly, events since the NATO incursion in Libya have made things far worse. The toppling of the Gaddafi government let loose a flood of arms, which extended to the entire region and had tremendous destabilizing effects. It led to a huge number of armed fighters, many of them of Islamist bent, and therefore it contributed to a growing civil war across the region, and that provided an excuse for Western intervention by both France and the U.S. And that has led to more turmoil, more anarchy, more chaos. Military intervention almost invariably makes things worse, and certainly the Sahel is a textbook example of why that is the case.
Now, during the G5 Sahel summit in N'Djamena, the host, Chadian President Idriss Deby, appealed for assistance from global partners.
More than 150 Malian soldiers have lost their lives, along with hundreds of civilians, in recent months. 4,500 French soldiers are in the Sahel as part of Operation Barkhane to fight terrorist forces. Security experts such as Ibrahim Maiga explain the resentment is not only directed at France, but also the Malian government.
While leaders in the Sahel region seem to officially welcome the presence of French troops, the masses have on several occasions come out to reject the presence of foreign troops. A civil rights activist in Mali questions the presence of French troops in his country. Let's take a listen.
What is this French presence for? It's useless. The French military, which we see as an occupying force, should go home.
President Macron says he will keep his country's troops in the Sahel region to continue fighting terrorism, despite the fact that masses in the region and even French citizens are opposed to the presence of the troops.
Well, I think that that Macron wants to keep a finger in the pie, just as other imperialist countries do as well, most especially the United States. But when the situation is fast deteriorating, as it is in the Sahel, it puts a country like France in a dilemma. It can't stay because its presence is making things worse by the month. But then it can't leave either because it's afraid of the consequences of the total chaos that might ensue, which would then spill over into Europe in the form of refugees primarily and perhaps terrorism as well.
France receives at least 75% of its energy from nuclear power, more than any other country in the world. According to some estimates, over 50% of the uranium ore extracted from Niger is used for fueling French nuclear power plants. The Sahel region is rich in resources, especially gold and uranium. Could this possibly be the main reason for continued presence of French troops in this region?
It undoubtedly is a very important factor in France's ongoing military intervention in the Sahel. France has material interest in the region. It wants to make sure that its resource needs are satisfied, and therefore it will do what it can to ensure that friendly governments are in place in the national capitals. But then again, the problem is always the same. France's presence leads to more chaos, more anarchy, more instability, and therefore France has got to keep committing more troops in order to maintain even a semblance of stability. It never works. The situation is unstable, it's getting worse, and the future looks extremely grim in terms of the former colonial countries.
Mr. Lazardia says that the future looks grim for the Sahel region. Indeed, the future is gloomy for Niger, a former French colony and also one of the poorest countries in the world. Now, despite vast reserves of uranium, which mostly goes to France, the vast majority of the population of 22 million is poor.
While Niger's uranium lights the Eiffel Tower and many homes in France, the people of Niger, the owners of this wealth, have no electricity and live in squalid conditions. A resident who lives near a French-owned uranium mine in Niger's Agadez region laments on her situation. Selling natural resources is the right of any country. However, Sahel countries languish in poverty, despite having strategic resources such as uranium and gold. Are they getting a raw deal from Western countries, especially France?
Undoubtedly they are. The Western countries regard them as playgrounds, as military training fields. They feel they can do whatever they want there, and they with little concern as to the consequences. So therefore, you know, more and more chaos erupts, and the imperial countries, the French, the U.S., etc., shrug their shoulders and carry on as usual, with little concern about the human cost. And the human cost is immense. I mean, the people in these regions lack the ability to create stable lives for themselves because of the anarchy that is continually stirred up by foreign intervention. I'm not trying to say that things would be fine if France and the U.S. just kept their hands off, because that's obviously unrealistic. But certainly French and U.S. Intervention are making things much worse.
Is the French and U.S. intervention the main source of the conflict in the region?
Well, I think it's certainly an important source, but there are many sources of conflict in the region. And that's just one of them. the region is caught in the crossfire between competing imperial interests, and therefore it is suffering terribly. But certainly, the foreign looting of domestic resources is one very important factor in pushing those countries over the edge of a cliff.
Speaking last October, the UN Secretary General said there is need for a renewed push for peace and reconciliation in the Sahel.
Violence is rising, and women and girls are especially vulnerable. Internal displacement has increased 20-fold in less than 2 years. The number of families facing hunger has tripled, climate change is threatening people's livelihoods, and COVID-19 is making all of it worse. We need to reverse this downward spiral with a renewed push for peace and reconciliation.
Now, as we conclude our interview, Mr. Lazar, can you tell us what needs to be done to restore peace in the Sahel?
Well, the most important thing that needs to be done is that France and the U.S. and other countries should withdraw their forces and leave it to the people themselves to work out their own problems. As I said, we must be realistic and realize that those problems won't be solved in a day. But certainly, removing Western intervention would certainly be an important first step.
Well, Mr. Lazar, there says that withdrawal of U.S. troops and French forces should be the initial step towards ending the conflict in the Sahel. Now, what do you think there? Do let us know through our social media handle.
Kenya's geothermal energy milestone.
Geothermal energy is heat within the earth. It's a renewable energy source because heat is continuously produced inside the earth. Let's have a look.
Geothermal power plants work like this. Pockets of water deep beneath the earth are superheated by magma or melted rock. The water is piped to the surface where boiling hot steam powers generators. There's little pollution and the supply of electricity can last for generations. That's because when the water is cooled, it's returned to the underground reservoir so the process can be repeated over and over again.
Kenya's Rift Valley region contains substantial geothermal energy, enough to power the country and beyond. The country has tapped this renewable energy and is now Africa's largest producer of geothermal energy and among the top 10 in the world. The current installed geothermal capacity in Kenya is 823 megawatts. With the untapped potential of 10,000 megawatts of geothermal energy, Kenya is on track to join the club of four countries with an installed 1,000 megawatts capacity or greater.
For more on Kenya's progress in utilizing geothermal power to power its economy, we have contacted Simon Kiragu, an energy practitioner and youth advocate. Now, thanks for your time, Mr. Kiragu. How has Kenya been able to develop into a leading geothermal energy producer in the world?
First of all, a major plus for us is the spectacular geological feature that we have, which is the Rift Valley. And the East Africa Rift Valley system has a potential of about 15,000 megawatts, of which Kenya boasts of an estimated 10,000 megawatts of that. So Kenya aims to develop and market and utilize more than 1,000 megawatts from the geothermal resources. And in my opinion, why Kenya is leading is one, there's an aspect of risk mitigation through the Geothermal Development Corporation. The government has developed steam fields and sells geothermal steam for electricity generation to both KenGen and also private investors. So this one takes away the risk that many investors are not willing to take, and also allowing investors to come in at a later, more proven stage of geothermal development.
Now, according to the International Energy Agency, in Kenya, access to electricity rose from 20% in 2013 to almost 85% in 2019. The use of geothermal energy is changing lives of people in Kenya. Mr. Muigai Kiragu, can you elaborate on how the use of geothermal energy has impacted on the economy and the daily lives of people, especially in terms of eradicating poverty?
By last year, geothermal accounted for more than 50% of the electricity generated in Kenya, and this has lowered the cost of power between 20 and 35% for both domestic and industrial consumers, respectively. So in this aspect, it has translated to the cost of doing business. Cost of power reduction will result to fairer cost of products, which will be felt by consumers. So also in terms of geothermal energy, over the recent years, there has been impacts. Like, for example, it has boosted tourism through the medicinal spas that we have in Naivasha. And also we have other economic models that are being currently piloted, which are going to have a ripple effect with the economy. Like, for example, using the geothermal energy for milk pasteurization, aquaculture, greenhouse heating. We have also heating of fish ponds.
Clearly, geothermal energy is having positive impact on the lives of the people in Kenya. Kenyan President Uhuru Kenyatta has been at the forefront of his country's quest for clean and renewable energy. At a groundbreaking ceremony for the Olkaria 5 geothermal power development project built by two Japanese firms and one Kenyan, Kenyatta voiced support for public-private sector partnership in such projects.
We should allow the private sector to also engage, so that through that public-private partnership, we are able to faster achieve our objectives of being energy self-sufficient, reliable power, cheap power, clean power, in a much faster time than the period that we've set ourselves for 2030. So mine is to really thank everybody who has been involved, the government of Japan, government of China.
As we know, geothermal exploration is risky and capital intensive. How has Kenya been able to overcome this challenge?
Indeed, geothermal exploration is capital intensive. Like, for example, drilling a 50 megawatts well cost about approximately $30 million USD at the testing phase, and also it takes about 3 years. So along the way, Kenya has received support from bilateral development, whereas like organizations like the United Nations are being instrumental in facilitating training of our engineers through the United Nations Geothermal Training Program. So, for example, last year, the Geothermal Development Corporation received about $2 billion from the Exchequer, which is in Kenya shillings, and towards capital expenditure, and about $4 billion are for steam sales and exchequer recurrent budget. So GDC has also further embarked with support from financing partners like African Union Commission through the Geothermal Risk Mitigation Facility.
The United Nations University has a postgraduate training program aiming at assisting developing countries in capacity building within geothermal exploration and development. The director of the United Nations University Geothermal Training Program speaks here on the importance of training in this sector.
If you want to have a serious development, you cannot only do it through consultants. You have to know yourself what you're doing. That's a key thing to a real success in geothermal development.
Do Kenyans have any technical expertise to produce geothermal energy or have to rely on foreign companies? And what steps have been taken to build indigenous capacity?
Of course, Kenya does have technical expertise, and sometimes they also have partnerships with some foreign countries to build the skills. And currently, Kenya has a hub for is a hub for skills, capacity, and technology transfer, and it boasts of a geothermal center of excellence, which is the Geothermal Development Corporation's in-house training facility. which was founded as a response to an existing regional skills gap in the geothermal energy subsector. So the center offers comprehensive peer-reviewed programs in all aspects of geothermal energy development. And also the Center of Excellence aims to upgrade the competence level of geothermists in the region through formal training of students, regional conferences where geothermists can share experiences, publications of biannual scientific journals that will document scientific developments in the geothermal subsector within the region.
Now, Mr. Muigai, you have talked there about Geothermal Energy Center of Excellence in Kenya. Now, are other regional countries with geothermal energy potential benefiting from Kenya's experience?
We have countries where the geothermal programs, where we have partnered with, like, for example, Djibouti, to have geothermal engineers trained at the Center of Excellence, and investing in these in experts with considerable experience in geothermal exploration and also drilling, and they will be able to build the capacities of teams within working with the projects. Like, for example, if I can add a little bit, we have also been able to benchmark with other countries for development of geothermal sites and projects. For example, we have Kenya has been working with a number of countries that include Kenya, that include Uganda, Tanzania, Djibouti, South Sudan, South Zambia, and Comoros. So these paradigm shifts has been able to cement Kenya's position as the ideal skill, capacity, and technology partner to other African countries.
Thank you for that, Mr. Kiragu Muigai, energy practitioner in Kenya, for that insight.
However, Kenya's geothermal energy production comes with its own challenges to the pristine environment and the local Maasai community.
We live a nomadic life system. We move from one place to another looking for pasture. We are fully dependent on livestock. We don't cultivate. Because of the pipeline network crossing from one corner of the locality to the other, that denies the access of animals to certain areas.
While traditional ways of life and the environment cannot remain unaffected by development projects, geothermal power remains greener than most alternatives.
Well, that's it for this edition of Africa Today. On behalf of the entire Africa Today team, I'd like to thank you all. Take care and goodbye for now.
This is the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran's broadcasting. The voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran is broadcast daily from 1920 to 2020 UTC on the following frequencies. Shortwave 49 meters, 6040 kilohertz for Europe, and 25 meters, 11,880 kilohertz for Southern Africa, and FM 91.5 megahertz for Tehran. You can also listen to the voice of the Islamic Republic of Iran on Hotbird Eutelsat 3B and Iran Sat or Bat 5 and via the internet. Our internet address is parstoday.com/en. And now you can listen to IRIB English Radio via your mobile phone. Please refer to our website for the details.
This is IRIB English Radio. Coming up is the news.